We hope and trust that you will find this Torah in Motion program meaningful. Through these programs, Torah in Motion encourages discussion, debate, and education about the most important issues facing Jews and Judaism today. Together, we can focus on creating religious commitment through an honest and sophisticated encounter with topics that are relevant to being Jewish in the modern world. For more information about this and other Torah in Motion programs, please visit the website at www.torahinmotion.org.
He just usually cancels it. It works anyways. Our next speaker is Dr. Nathan Herman, who graduated from the University of Toronto and specialized in psychiatry also in Toronto. He's Chief of Geriatric Psychiatry at Sunnybrook and Women's College Services Center and an Associate Professor in the Department of Psychiatry, University of Toronto. His topic will be Care, Consent, and Capacity, the Treatment of Dementia.
Good afternoon, and thank you for staying. All I can say is that's an incredible, stark contrast. What you've heard for the last hour are events that should be, and in Yirtzeh Hashem, will be outside of the normal realm of human experience. What I have come to talk to you today is about very mundane things. Mundane in the sense that Alzheimer's disease and dementia is something that will touch every single person in this audience directly, likely over the next few years, just by the demographics of our aging society and the prevalence of this illness in the community. Now, having said all that, I want to say right from the start that I was very reluctant to agree to speak today. And the most important reason I was reluctant to speak is because I'm not an ethicist. I'm a clinician and a clinical pharmacology researcher. And in fact, I sometimes believe that institutional review ethic boards were designed specifically to sort of protect innocent patients against evil clinical researchers like myself. So to speak at a medical ethics conference probably is not the best place for a researcher like myself to be. On the other hand, as someone involved in the management and research of Alzheimer's disease patients that touch on so many medical, legal, and ethical issues, I believe I certainly am aware of these issues, and I definitely take them into account in my day-to-day care of these patients and their families. The topic that was given to me was care, consent, and capacity, treatment of Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. And here again, walking into this room, my heart sank a bit because I recognize that many of you are not physicians. And in fact, this talk was meant for physicians. So having said all that and made as many apologies as I think I should at this point, I'll go on with my talk. But what I'll try and do, while I'm going to be highlighting issues related to care, I will emphasize what are the ethical issues raised by the management of Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. And I will try to present the issues related to treatment in a way that would be acceptable to every member of the audience, whether they are, in fact, physicians or not physicians, which may not be the easiest thing in the world. Anyway. Uh-oh. So, I think I'm frozen. No, I don't think so, or we'll be here for another 10 minutes. Okay.
Angeles?
Yeah.
Here?
Oh.
That's what it is here.
I did.
Did you know?
Okay. All right. Anyways, we're working now. Okay. Very important for someone like myself who's a clinical pharmacology researcher to make sure that you understand that lots of my research is funded by the pharmaceutical industry. And having said that, I deal with many different companies, and I believe I'm sort of equally biased to a pharmacological approach from many different perspectives. Okay, a little bit about dementia and Alzheimer's disease. As I said, it's a very common problem. About 8%, these are Canadian study data, about 8% of people in the community over the age of 65 will have a diagnosable dementing illness. That increases to close to 30% in people over 85 years of age. However, even in the oldest of our population, not everybody has a dementia or Alzheimer's disease. So it's not inevitable with aging. And in fact, some of you may have remembered Jeanne Calmette, who was a French lady who died at the age of 121, making into the Guinness Book of World Records. She actually had detailed neuropsychological testing done when she was close to 120. That suggested she probably was not demented. So dementia is not inevitable with aging. The incidence does double for every 5 years of age after the age of 65, and there are 60,000 new cases in Canada every year. At the present time, there's about 300,000 people in Canada that would be diagnosed as having Alzheimer's disease. So a huge public health problem. There are many causes of dementia. Alzheimer's disease is by far the most common, but there are many other common causes, including vascular dementia, dementia with Lewy bodies, frontotemporal dementia, and a number of other causes. And again, I don't think it's important for today's talk to go into the differential diagnosis. Because Alzheimer's disease is by far the most common cause, we're going to focus today on that and its treatment. It represents at least 60%, and probably more, of all the dementias. It typically occurs in mid to late life. It has a very variable course. They say that you can live anywhere from 2 to 15 years after formally diagnosed, and the average is about 6 to 8 years. It is a progressive illness at the moment in terms of what we have in terms of treatment. Death is usually due to the physical deterioration associated with the illness, and about 5% are familial Alzheimer's disease. In other words, these are families that have direct genetic linkages, where in every single generation, about 50% of illness, 50% of people have the illness. And of course, that will raise an issue related to genetic testing. In terms of how physicians make the diagnosis, it involves multiple cognitive deficits. It must include memory impairment and then at least one other type of cognitive impairment, such as aphasia, which is a language or communication disorder, apraxia is a disorder of being able to manipulate objects or do things, agnosia is the ability to recognize objects, or rather the inability to recognize objects, and then disturbances of higher functions, such as insight and judgment. And these deficits must be sufficient to impair social or occupational functioning. Clinicians make the diagnosis based on a history taken from the patient as well as taken from family members or some other person who can provide collaborative history, a physical examination, laboratory investigations, and according to the Canadian Consensus Conference on Dementia, very few laboratory tests actually need to be done. These include simply a CBC, electrolytes, thyroid function test, glucose and calcium. And not everyone requires the fancy neuroimaging CT, MRI, or SPECT scan. In fact, the Canadian Consensus Conference on Dementia recommends imaging only in cases that meet these criteria. So in other words, cases that are unlikely to be Alzheimer's disease, where you're going to do a scan and find something that suggests it's not Alzheimer's disease. So we're going to now focus on the management. The first issue with respect to management is one of the most trickiest and difficult issues, and that's communicating the diagnosis. And that raises a whole issue which I understand you've already talked about this morning or today, and that's truth-telling. This becomes very, very complicated in dementia, because obviously the person who has the illness has developed some degree of cognitive impairment. They have difficulty with their memory, concentration. They have difficulty understanding abstract concepts. So what does it mean to tell that person that they have an illness like Alzheimer's disease? It can be very, very tricky. Of course, we as clinicians face the scenario almost daily where family members come to you before you've had a chance to speak to the patient and say, whatever you do, don't tell my mother or my father that they have Alzheimer's disease, because that will kill them. Of course, it's, again, a problem that we have in all areas of medicine, but it becomes a particularly important thing in Alzheimer's disease, as I mentioned, where the cognitive abilities to understand the diagnosis and the implication of the diagnosis is impaired by the illness itself. The next important thing in terms of management involves a safety assessment, and that includes looking at things like suicidality and violence. Unfortunately, many people with Alzheimer's disease can become severely depressed and suicidal. They can become violent and aggressive. These are individuals that can wander and are subject to falls. There is the specter of neglect and abuse, both in terms of the neglect that a caregiver may have for the patient and abuse that the patient may have for the caregiver. And finally, another very important ethical issue is related, and this is a medical, legal, and ethical issue, relates to driving. In our society, the ability to drive is considered often a God-given right. And it is also mandated by the province of Ontario, for instance, that physicians, when they suspect an illness that is going to impair a person's ability to drive, they must inform the Ministry of Transportation, who then investigates and decides whether to take the driving license away or not. I frequently get requests from family physicians where it's clear to me that the reason they're being referred to me is not because they don't, the family physician is not aware of the diagnosis of dementia, but they feel uncomfortable being the people to take away the driving license. And I certainly have no problem taking away driving license when I believe that that needs to be done. After a safety assessment comes the issues of caregiver education and support. And when I look after people with dementia, I spend far more time with the caregiver than I actually spend with the patient themselves. Nobody leaves my office after being given a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease without the telephone number of the Alzheimer's Disease Society of Metropolitan Toronto. We talk about things like education and support. We talk about what kinds of things we can do in the community to help caregivers and to help patients, including things like day programs, respite care, and home supports. The other very important issues relate to medical legal issues, including the ability to make sure, or the ability to make a power of attorney, both for finances and for personal care decisions and wills. And the Alzheimer's Society refers to this as decision making and respecting individual choice. We want to try, if at all possible, to get to people while they still have the cognitive facilities to make important decisions about their future, to make important decisions about who is going to make decisions for them when they become impaired, and then decide on things like where their estate is going to go. So this is another important issue highlighted by the Alzheimer's Society of Canada. In terms of ongoing things with management, we want to assess and treat comorbid medical illnesses, paying very special attention to sensory impairment. One of the things that we're learning, for instance, is that individuals with Alzheimer's disease that have hearing impairment or visual impairment are actually much more likely to develop delusions and hallucinations, to develop sort of psychiatric symptoms. And by optimizing their ability to hear and to see, we can actually treat some of these problems and maybe even improve their cognition as well. As I mentioned, we want to assess and treat behavioral disturbances. Depression occurs in about 20% of people with Alzheimer's disease. Hallucinations and delusions between 20 and 30%. Agitation and aggression, 40 to 90% depending on what time in the illness we're talking about, whether it's earlier or later in the illness, and what degree of agitation or aggression we're talking about. So the other thing that's very important in terms of assessing and treating behavioral disturbances is that one of the things we know it's usually not the cognitive impairment that ends up getting people placed in long-term care facilities. It's the behavioral disturbances, the agitation, the aggression, the perseverative questioning of caregivers, the sort of wearing them down, the waking up in the middle of the night and getting dressed and wandering around and making themselves breakfast when it's 3 o'clock in the morning, waking up the spouse. These are the kinds of behaviors that ends up getting people institutionalized, and it's not, you know, forgetting where they put their car keys. After we've done all of those things, and that really takes up the bulk of time today, we can think about treating and possibly preventing cognitive decline. And before I talk about some of the individual interventions that are available today, I want to make sure that people understand that there are some other things that need to be done as well. And these are things like assessing and treating vascular risk factors. Now, I'm focusing today on Alzheimer's disease, but one of the things that we've learned from the Nunn study, some of you may have heard of that fantastic epidemiological study going on with a large order of nuns in the United States at the moment. But we've learned from the Nunn study that vascular risk factors or vascular lesions, so tiny small strokes that are sometimes undocumentable by medical treatment or by physicians, can very much interfere with a person's cognitive ability if they have Alzheimer's disease. And that's often the thing that sort of tips the balance and makes somebody who has the pathology of Alzheimer's disease begin to become demented. In other words, develop significant cognitive impairment. So making sure we're treating high blood pressure, making sure we're treating people with statins to lower their cholesterol level, treating people prophylactically with low-dose ASA, these are all things that are crucial for the management of Alzheimer's disease. And only then, as I said, can we look towards cognitive enhancement therapy, which is the sort of new kid on the block. If we're talking about cognitive enhancers, there's a variety of approaches that can be thought of today. There's a new class of drugs called the cholinesterase inhibitors that I'll tell you about. There's vitamin E and something called selegiline. There's ginkgo biloba, which is a treatment from a health food store, anti-inflammatory drugs, and estrogen. And I'll talk briefly about all of these. Before I do that, I want to make sure that for the clinicians in the audience, they understand when I talk about cognitive enhancement therapy, what the goals of therapy are. This is the mini mental state examination. This is a cognitive screening examination that gives you a score out of 30 that tells you how impaired an individual is with respect to their ability to concentrate and remember things. It runs from 0 to 30, with 30 being perfect and 0 being fully, completely impaired. And this is the life of an Alzheimer's disease patient from diagnosis, running anywhere from 0 to 6 years after diagnosis. And as you can see, the scores on the mini mental state decline over the course of time. In terms of treating a person with Alzheimer's disease, the ideal drug, of course, would be something like drug A. You could give it at any point in this decline, and it shoots their cognition back to normal, and it stays normal. There are no drug A's on the market today. There will be no drug A's on the market likely for 10 years. So what would be the next best thing? That would be drug B. You give it to them at any point in the illness, and it stops the illness from progressing. We can't get them back to where they were when they were in their 20s or 30s with respect to memory and concentration, but at least we're making sure they're not getting any worse. Well, there are no drug B's on the market today, and unlikely to be drug B's for 5 to 10 years. So the next best thing is what we actually have. It's not a totally bad story today, and that's drug C's. They improve cognition to some degree, but then the person will continue to decline. Now, the way the slope is here pretty much parallels the natural decline of the illness. That's probably not true. The drugs that we have today are probably a little bit better than drug C, and they do slow progression to some degree. The cholinesterase inhibitors are the class of drugs that we have available today that are marketed in Canada. Acetylcholine is a neurotransmitter, a chemical involved in passing messages from one brain cell to another, and particularly involved in parts of the brain that affect cognition, particularly memory. One of the things we've known for over 20 years is that people with Alzheimer's disease have significant, very marked declines in this neurotransmitter in their brains. And there have been a variety of different approaches to try and increase the amount of acetylcholine activity in the brains of people with Alzheimer's disease. And it's only been recently that we found a class of drugs that can actually do this and is well tolerated, and that's the cholinesterase inhibitors. These are drugs that block the enzyme that breaks down acetylcholine in the synaptic cleft. And if you stop the breakdown of this neurotransmitter, you have more of it available to act as a messenger between nerve cells. And therefore, you increase the function of the cholinergic system. These drugs have been shown to improve memory, function, and behavior, and that's very important. It's not simply that these drugs help you remember where you left your keys in the morning. They also help in terms of function, in terms of things like dressing, bathing, feeding oneself, and in terms of behavior. They are very effective at reducing things like hallucinations and agitation and apathy, which can be very important, as I mentioned before. They do, as a group, have potential side effects. These include nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, dizziness, weakness, and muscle cramps. They are somewhat different from drug to drug, and if you develop it with one, it doesn't necessarily mean you'll have it with another. Because of the action of these medications, you do need to be careful in certain medical conditions, things like chronic obstructive pulmonary disease or asthma, peptic ulcer disease, and some types of cardiac arrhythmias, particularly where there's a tendency to slow the heart. Now, there are three cholinesterase inhibitors that are available on the market today. Donepezil or Aricept has been available for a number of years. Rivastigmine is about 2.5 years old, and galantamine is about 6 to 8 months old. Just to give you an idea about the kind of effect you can get, and I won't even do this in any great detail, but this was the first study that was published, one of the pivotal studies published on donepezil back in 1998. So you can see these really are very young drugs. And this was the first drug that was available in Canada. So this was a large study that looked at the effect of this medication in people with mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease. And what you see at the bottom there in terms of these funny letters here are the scales, the outcome measures. And the FDA and the HPB, the Food and Drug Administration in the United States and Health Protection Branch in Canada, made it very clear to the manufacturers of cognitive enhancer drug for Alzheimer's disease that it's not good enough just to show improvement in memory and concentration. You also have to be able to demonstrate that globally, people can recognize that there's an improvement on these drugs. And that's what these two scales do. The ADAS-Cog is the measure of concentration and memory and other cognitive functions. The CIVIC is a global measure of improvement that is composite of the impression of the physician, the patient, and the family member. So people had to be able to tell you they were better in a global sense on these medications. Again, without looking at the details of this chart, I can tell you that these drugs are modestly effective. If you look at the difference between a placebo and the active medication, there's about a 3-point difference. On this particular cognitive scale, it declines naturally in the community in a patient with Alzheimer's disease by about 7 to 8 points per year. So, in other words, 3-point change compared to placebo represents about 6 months of cognitive life. So you're going to say, well, what the heck does 6 months mean to a person with Alzheimer's disease? That's a good question. But there are a number of patients that respond in a very, very significant way. That's a sort of 7-point. This would be a full year of cognitive life for someone with Alzheimer's disease. And as you can see, you are tripling the chance that a person is going to have a dramatic response to the medication by giving them the active drug. Unfortunately, in this study, after all the patients were put on placebo and washed out, they all appeared equal. So in this study, we were not able to demonstrate that it had a disease progression or disease modifying effect. It just looked symptomatic. Now, I can tell you that it's difficult to decide. We have three of these medications on the market today, and it's very difficult to decide which of these three drugs to use. This is a list that I devised to try and help us decide things like effectiveness, tolerability, drug interactions, cost, how easy it is to use the drugs, and the science. And just to go through some of these, again, I'm not going to go in any great detail. I can tell you that we've done very detailed meta-analysis of all the studies, and statistically, there is no difference in terms of effectiveness of any of these drugs. So donepezil, rivastigmine, and galantamine, based on the studies that have been published to date, are all identical. And I'm not even going to go through that. So effectiveness does not help us in terms of choosing which medication. Tolerability. Again, if you look at dropout rates or rates of adverse effects, there are no different in any of the studies that have been published to date. I can tell you, however, that clinicians have the sense that donepezil is probably the best tolerated with respect to nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea, and rivastigmine tends to be the worst. It tends to be the harshest on the stomach, with galantamine being somewhere in the middle. On the other hand, donepezil is the drug that causes the most in the way of sleep impairment and bad dreams. We used to, when the drug was initially prescribed, we used to give it at bedtime, and most clinicians now are switching to the morning to try and avoid its negative effects on sleep. There is some suggestion that both galantamine and rivastigmine actually improve sleep patterns in Alzheimer's disease patients. So there are differences in terms of tolerability, but how important those are, again, is difficult to know because certainly in terms of the randomized control trials, there were no differences. Drug interactions, they are all extremely safe with respect to drug interactions, and that really shouldn't help us in terms of deciding which drug to use. Cost, as you can imagine, the drug companies marketed these drugs at exactly the same cost, so that is absolutely no difference, and the cost actually is about $5 per day. In terms of ease of administration, donepezil gets the nod. It's a single daily medication that is started at 5 milligrams and it's increased to 10 milligrams after 1 month. Rivastigmine is twice a day. It's much more difficult to use because you have to start it at 1.5 milligrams twice a day. After a month, you go to 3 twice a day. After another month, you go to 4.5 twice a day. And after another month, possibly to 6 twice a day. So there's a large number of dose steps over several months. Galantamine is a very interesting drug. It is also twice a day, and you start at 4 milligrams twice a day and increase to 8 milligrams twice a day after a month. And this is where, unfortunately, the drug was marketed to stop. It's marketed to stop at 8 milligrams. However, most of the studies that have been done to date suggest that you really need to push it to 12 milligrams twice a day in order to get efficacy. So that's an important thing to remember. So again, if you're looking at ease of administration and how long it takes to titrate to an effective dose, donepezil may get a nod there with galantamine being next and rivastigmine being the most difficult. In terms of the science, again, I'm not going to spend much time on this except to tell you that these are three completely different drugs. Although they all work by inhibiting this enzyme called acetylcholinesterase, they all have other effects that make them very, very different. In fact, both rivastigmine and galantamine are marketed as dual action drugs because unlike donepezil that only works on acetylcholinesterase, rivastigmine also works on something called butyrylcholinesterase, which we believe may have a role to play in Alzheimer's disease, and galantamine is a nicotinic receptor modulator, and that is another way of increasing the amount of acetylcholine in the synaptic cleft. So they all work completely different. And that leads to the question, if at first you don't succeed, should you try another? And we don't have any data yet that formally tests whether this is true or not, but I think many clinicians, based on some preliminary clinical sense, are switching people from one cholinesterase to another if you don't see a response after about 6 months, or if you see the person declining at the rate that you'd expect them to decline. Just to emphasize another important point, dementia with Lewy bodies is, depending on whose research you believe, either the second, the third, or the fourth most common cause of dementia. It is similar to Alzheimer's disease in a way. These people also have significant Parkinsonian features. And the interesting thing about this illness is that its cholinergic deficit is even greater than in people with Alzheimer's disease. And therefore, this would seem to be the ideal illness to treat with a cholinesterase esterase inhibitor. And in fact, the data that we have from preliminary studies suggests that people respond even better to cholinesterase inhibitors if they have dementia with Lewy bodies. So a very important diagnosis to think about. Just last week, or just it's actually 2 weeks ago, in The Lancet, the first study of cholinesterase inhibitors in vascular dementia and Alzheimer's disease with vascular disease associated with it was published. And again, we're seeing almost identical efficacy compared to Alzheimer's disease. So it seems that the cholinesterase inhibitors are good for many different types of dementia, whether it's Alzheimer's disease, dementia with Lewy bodies, or vascular dementia. And in fact, we believe that probably there are only a few types of dementia where it would not be helpful. Frontotemporal dementia, we believe it would not be helpful. So illnesses like Pick's disease and possibly illnesses like progressive supranuclear palsy, it may not be helpful and may in fact be somewhat harmful. Just to go on and very briefly to let you know about some of the other things that have been looked at, vitamin E, there is one study published to date that had questionable results because of, unfortunately, a flaw in the design, but it suggested that vitamin E and this other medication called selegiline, which is marketed for the use of Alzheimer's, for the use of Parkinson's disease patients, may have some benefit. These act as antioxidants, and that raises the issue of whether, in fact, other more powerful antioxidants might eventually be helpful. Vitamin E is being trialed in two large studies now in the United States at the moment, so we will know again whether vitamin E is helpful sometime in the next year or two. Ginkgo, as I mentioned, is a medication or a herbal preparation. I said medication, it really is a medication, but it's marketed as a herbal preparation in health food stores. It is also believed to be an antioxidant, and while there is a tremendous amount of literature from German studies, there's actually only one North American study that has looked at it. If this would have been, it did show some efficacy. If this would have been something that needed FDA approval to get marketed for the treatment of Alzheimer's disease, it would not have met criteria for marketing because although it did show a benefit in terms of its score on memory, concentration, and other cognitive deficits, there was no difference in terms of its sort of clinical global improvement. So it would not have met the FDA criteria for approval for as a drug for Alzheimer's disease. I get lots of questions from family caregivers about whether they should put their relatives on ginkgo biloba. After all, it's available in the health food store, so it must be safe. It must be okay to use. And my answer to them is it's, first of all, very, very expensive. Second of all, every manufacturer's preparation is different than another manufacturer's preparation. There are 1,000 active ingredients in the extract of ginkgo. We have no clue which of those active ingredients is supposed to be effective in Alzheimer's disease. And as I said, because of difficulties in terms of how it's prepared, it's really something that I, as a clinician, cannot recommend. On the other hand, it is reasonably well tolerated, and at the moment we are not aware of any significant drug interactions, although there are some drug interactions that can occur with it. So it's not as if it's a completely innocuous substance. Anti-inflammatories, these are aspirin-type drugs. There is evidence that if you look at the pathology of Alzheimer's disease, inflammation plays a very important role. And that led people to believe that if we can treat the inflammation, we may be able to treat the Alzheimer's disease. And although this is a biologically plausible theory, at the moment we don't have very good evidence that, in fact, this works. One of the problems is that anti-inflammatory drugs, most anti-inflammatory drugs like aspirin, do not cross the blood-brain barrier very well. They don't actually get into the brain very well. And so it's difficult to get the active medication to the tissue that has the pathology. There's a small trial of indomethacin, which is a terrible drug we would never use in older people, that suggests that it is effective. People have tried prednisone in a large study done in the United States, which only showed that you can induce a lot of vertebral fractures in elderly patients, but you can't improve their cognitions with the drug. There's another study with hydroxychloroquine, another drug which has anti-inflammatory properties, that suggests that it's not effective. And there are a number of studies with COX-2 inhibitors that are underway, and they will likely not be helpful either. Unfortunately, COX-2 inhibitors, as you know, the fancy new arthritis drugs, are extremely well tolerated, but based on their mechanism of action, they actually probably won't be helpful in Alzheimer's disease, and it's the old COX-1 inhibitors or nonspecific COX inhibitors that are likely going to be effective, drugs like ibuprofen and naproxen, which are being studied in the United States and in Canada at the moment. But we don't know about those yet. Estrogen, again, another biologically plausible treatment for Alzheimer's disease. We know that women who have gone through menopause are at higher risk for developing Alzheimer's disease than males who are the same age. And we know from trials that have been done, sort of the epidemiological studies that have done, that women who have undergone estrogen or hormone replacement therapy have lower rates of Alzheimer's disease than women who've refused estrogen replacement therapy. Having said all that, there are a number of trials that were published over the last 2 years that showed that hormone replacement therapy is completely useless for people that already have Alzheimer's disease. What we don't know is whether if we give women before they have any signs or symptoms of Alzheimer's disease estrogen, will that stop the disease from occurring? And those studies are actually underway as we speak as well. So in terms of the pharmacological management of dementia today, as I mentioned, I think it's exceedingly important to treat vascular risk factors. I believe that every patient with Alzheimer's disease and probably every patient with vascular dementia, dementia with Lewy bodies, should be treated with a cholinesterase inhibitor. I think vitamin E is still up in the air. I recommend it to my patients because it's quite cheap and unlikely to get them into trouble in terms of drug interactions. I would not recommend estrogen or hormone replacement therapy today, specifically for the treatment of Alzheimer's disease or the prophylaxis of Alzheimer's disease. I do not recommend treatment with non-steroidal anti-inflammatory today, but we will know more about those in the near future. In terms of the somewhat more distant future, there's a lot of very, very exciting things going on in Alzheimer's disease therapeutics. These include, as you may have heard, the vaccine, which unfortunately was stopped from development about a month ago. However, there are a number of other vaccines that are being developed. There are a number of drugs that are looking exceedingly like they have great potential in terms of blocking the deposition of amyloid and the hyperphosphorylation of tau, which are the two important pathological features of the illness, and a number of other approaches that are being actively researched. Depending on the year, Alzheimer's disease therapeutics is the number one indication for new drug development protocols in the world. It's either number one or number two. Sometimes the antibiotics reach number one. Sometimes it's Alzheimer's disease. But for the last few years, Alzheimer's disease therapeutics has really been up there. So I am quite confident that we will have a pharmacological cure for this illness probably within about 10 years. Now, getting back to the issue of ethics, I just want to say that the Alzheimer's Society of Canada has highlighted the eight most important that they believe through consensus are the most important ethical issues facing clinicians and families and patients. These include, as I mentioned before, the issue of communicating the diagnosis and how that's done, issues related to driving, decision-making, quality of life, participation in research, genetic testing, use of restraints, and end-of-life issues. And I'm going to put this back up for, I guess, Dr. Steinberg, who will be the discussant. But just to let you know that there are a number of valuable resources that you might be interested in. The first is the conclusions of the Canadian Consensus Conference on Dementia, which was published in the Canadian Medical Association Journal in 1999, that provides guidelines for the management of Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. There is the Tough Issue series, that slide that I just showed you, available on the Alzheimer's Disease Canada website. And with respect to the Mental Health Act and the Substitute Decisions Act regarding rights and responsibilities, mental health and the law, and how to deal with incompetent patients, the Government of Ontario's website has this rights and responsibilities package that does a very nice job of explaining issues related to the medical legal care of people with Alzheimer's disease and people that are incompetent. So I think I will put back up, if I can, the slide highlighting some of the ethical issues. And I guess we'll have Dr. Steinberg.
I just want to say this is, I did not warn you in advance.
Oh.
Without this is...